So where are we up to?
God is expressing loving kindness. That means to bestow benefit, the good, on some other. We are that other. The good that he bestows is godliness, because he is the greatest good. Since he is the greatest good, the good that he gives is himself. Of course, a creature can't be God, but as much godliness as a creature can have, that's what he's giving to us. And that's why he's giving the greatest good that a creature can have. Now, that means we are to end up possessing characteristics similar to his. Well, one central, in a certain sense, the central characteristic that he has is that he's self-determined. Totally self-determined. He is what he is only because of himself. We share something of that characteristic. Of course, we can't be totally self-determined as he is so totally self-determined, because we're creatures. We can only be partly self-determined. And the way in which we are self-determined in part is not the same way in which he is self-determined. We are self-determined in part via, through free will. Free will. We're self-determined through the exercise of free will. He is self-determined by his own nature. Okay, but in the end, he is what he is because of himself. Certain aspects of what we are because of us, ourselves. And that we can resemble him. Furthermore, the other aspects in which we need to resemble him all depend upon free will. The moral characteristics, spiritual characteristics, which could resemble his nature, all depend upon free will. Without free will, you don't have them. Loving kindness was the example I gave you yesterday. A thing can't have the characteristic of loving kindness unless it's self-determined. If it's a tool in the hands of something else, then loving kindness doesn't apply to it. And therefore, it's only through the exercise of our free will that we acquire the property of loving kindness, the characteristic of loving kindness, and that way comes to resemblance. So free will now is really the basis of the whole resemblance. The whole resemblance trades on free will. And that means the whole of the goodness that we can possess, the godliness, which is that goodness that we can possess, depends upon free will. That's what we said yesterday. Everybody's together up to there? This shows you why free will is so important. Here again, the Ramchal derives the conclusion that everybody agrees with. Free will is really crucial. Sukkim talk about it, and the various other sources talk about it. I think the Ramchal's perspective, the deepest that I know, why we need it. So it's not an axiom, so it's a theorem system, based on deeper ideas. Now, how is free will implemented? How does God build free will? This creature, whoever it is, has to possess free will in order to possess the good. I said we're that creature, but I didn't say why or how we achieve that goal. Free will depends crucially on concept. Free will occurs when there's a conflict, a pull, two pulls in opposite directions, or three or four or five, at least two, and then free will is the deciding factor. Without opposed motivations, there is no free will. I'll try to say a little more. What is the free will choosing between? The free will can't be choosing just between possibilities. There are many possibilities out there that don't resonate with me, to use this ugly slang that people talk about. Put it in literal terms, there are many possibilities out there for which I have no motivation at all. Then my free will doesn't choose between them. They're not items that are available for free will. In order for my free will to make a choice between A and B, I have to be drawn to both A and B. I have to have a natural push towards both A and B. If I don't have that, then free will has no purchase. Here's an example that was given in a philosophy paper a number of years ago, which I thought was very revealing, very dramatic. You're standing next to a pool, and at your feet, an 18-month-old child falls into the pool. You're the only one standing near the pool. Now, if you leave the child alone, he's going to drown. But all you have to do is lean down and grab the back of his shirt and pull him out. Let's see, he's 18 months old, probably weighs about 15 pounds, 20 pounds, 15, 20 pounds, right? It's not a strain. You're not going to fall in. You wouldn't even get your pants wet. You know, you just pick him up and set him down again. Now, this philosopher said, let's think, what motivations do you have for saving his life, for pulling him out of the pool? Well, you're saving a human life, and the parents will love you forever. Friends and relatives and observers will have you with the greatest respect. Right? Okay, those are the motivations in favor of pulling him out. What motivations do you have against pulling him out? I'm not speaking theoretically now. What motivations could a moral monster have? But think about yourself. What motivations would you have for not pulling him out, just letting him drown?
You don't want to get wet.
Is that realistic about you? I doubt it very much. As I said, don't think about possibilities now. You know, out of the phone. I want to, you know, realistically, for the normal person, there are no motivations against. Everything in your personality is in favor. Says the author of this article, then you're not making a choice. You're not making a choice. Because the other alternative doesn't pull you in any way. It doesn't connect with you. Nothing in your psychology is drawn to it or attracted to it.
So you don't get the mitzvah.
Correct. Correct. This is not an exercise of free will. In the terms that we discussed at the very end last night, yesterday, you know, there's no mitzvah in it. That's quite correct. I'm prepared to follow that. This is quite correct. Free will requires you to be pulled, motivated in both directions. Free will is a choice between motivated alternatives, not just logical and physical alternatives, but motivated alternatives. Therefore, says Raphael, the human being has to be constructed in such a way that he will have conflicting motivations. That is the reason why a human being has a body and a soul. That's the reason. The human being is the only creature that is made out of two different entities opposed to one another. There is no other creature that's built that way. Every other creature is one dimensional. The animals, the angels, whatever you want, are one dimensional. Only a human being is two dimensional, with two items which are naturally pulled in two different directions, so that the free will can make the choice between the struggle between those two directions. And when you have a case where there is no struggle, where the human being, with his body and soul, is so lopsided that all of his motivations are on one side, in the case we just discussed, for example, then indeed, there's no free will, and there's no responsibility, and there's no reward and punishment. It's something which free will doesn't apply to.
Yeah, but there's always something, there's always time that, like, if you decide to pull the baby out, you could have done something else with your time. Like, so there's always something pulling you on the other end.
Let's understand this carefully now. There's a difference between saying there's something I could have done versus saying there was something I was motivated to do. And my claim is, just knowing there's something you could have done isn't enough. For example, one of the things I could have done was stand there and let him drown. I could have done that. I'm capable of it physically anyway. But I'm not psychologically capable of it because nothing in my motivation would draw me to do that. So there, the fact that I could have done it means nothing. It doesn't mean I have free will. To have free will means that I have two alternative bubbles which are motivating me. And then I choose which motivation to fulfill.
Sorry, are you saying that for someone who is naturally just able every day to go double, it's not a problem, it's not a mitzvah because at the end of the day, it's what they do every day, and it's not as if they're kind of pushing themselves to do that kind of thing. There's only one thing you can do.
This depends. We spoke about this yesterday. Let's review it. It depends upon how they got that way. We said yesterday, if your parents programmed you to daven, so that by the time you're 11, you're davening, and as you just put it, there's no choice because that's the only thing you do, nothing else draws you, nothing else interests you, nothing competes with it, then indeed, when you become 13, for the rest of your life, you may get no credit for davening. Correct, because you're not making any choice. So we said yesterday, what then will be the mitzvah in the davening for such a person? Pay attention to every word. That he wasn't trained to do. And that he certainly mind can wander. And that requires a tremendous effort on his part to do. So his free will will not apply to the davening itself. His free will apply to the paying attention. Everyone's free will applies somewhere or other. Right? But if there's no opposing motivation, then indeed there's no choice, there's no free will, and there's no responsibility.
So what if once he's achieved that goal, paying attention to every single word, I mean, what would be the mitzvah in davening after that?
When you get to that point, let me know. I'll tell you. It's endless. It's really endless. Yeah.
So
as I say, the Shulchan Aruch says, the Shulchan Aruch, which ought to be the standard for everybody, the Shulchan Aruch says when a person davens, he should lose consciousness of his physical surroundings entirely. Now, I just want to know whether when such a person davens and a siren goes by, he registers that there's a siren or doesn't register that there's a siren? He registers that he's not here. That may be the next stage. Right? If you read the works on Phil, you'll see that this goes on. Yes?
Okay, good thing. So let's say there's a fire in the house and you're risking your life to go in. Now you have a legitimate other choice, you don't risk your life,
that's
say the person. So then, sometimes you do get credit for something because you have a choice,
that's
right?
That's right.
Next thing is, now the question is, can a person, let's say even a drug addict, if you're covering, quitting the habit, compared to, let's say, a person that prays three times a day, can that person who's giving up the habit and really going in a positive direction and growing, even though he has shaky evidence of beliefs, can he have a higher spiritual level than the person that prays three times a day?
Well, I don't think it's helpful. I don't think it's probably it's reasonable to talk about overall level or overall credit. I think you have to take it action by action or motivation by motivation. Otherwise, you're going to end up comparing apples and oranges. So, if you're talking about how much credit he gets for davening mincha, when part of it wants to go and get the drugs and he's fighting that battle simultaneously, versus someone who's brought up to do it, of course he'll get more credit because he's making a much bigger effort to do it. The Gemara said, the more effort you put into the action, the more credit for it you get.
But there's another thing which is a spiritual level. We're not talking about that, right? It's something totally separate.
The credit you get depends, I was going to speak on this in a minute, but the credit you get depends only on your effort.
So Tzaddik, let's say, he doesn't put much effort because it became nature to him. So from that point on, that it became second nature, he doesn't get credit.
We spoke about this yesterday. If he developed that level on his own, and it took him years of effort to develop that level, and afterward that level is easy to maintain, he gets all the credit because he developed it for himself. We were talking before about someone whose parents broke it. But if you do it for yourself, you get credit forever on the basis of the effort that you put in. Yeah?
How do you know that he was getting credit? Maybe why can't he get credit because his parents did good things? His parents said, we're going to... He can bear it on behalf of his parents. His parents said, we're going to train our kids not three times a day. So the parents did a good deed. Or they made another set of parents that we're not going to train our kid. So since the parents did a good deed, the kid can get credit for it. He can benefit on their behalf.
Why should the child get benefit for the good deed that the parents did?
Yes.
Why should, let's say, Why shouldn't the parents get the credit for the good deed that they did?
They can both get it. When a volunteer father, let's say a father decides he goes out and he works hard in school and he makes a lot of money, becomes a doctor or something. His children benefit because he worked very hard. Same way, the parents decide this way we want to raise him, this child's going to benefit. It doesn't have to be spiritually also.
Okay, good. Now, I want to just mention as a piece of logic here. I've been giving logic points this all the way through. If you make the point over again and change your vocabulary, that's a red flag. You first ask the question in terms of credit, and now you ask it in terms of benefit. You change the vocabulary. Ah, but there's a gigantic difference between credit and benefit. Benefit, they surely can. That I agree with you 100%. But credit is just something you do yourself, not something they've done to you.
But the benefit is the credit. By you get the credit, you get the mitzvah, they benefit. That's
but your example was money. Money is a different kind of benefit. Benefit in general you can do, but you can't get credit for something you didn't do. It doesn't even in logic make sense. Why should I get credit for something I didn't do? Credit? I didn't do it. Doesn't make me a better person because he did something to me. Let me give you an example. The poor guy comes by and asks me for charity. I say, no. You? Charity? Forget it. Get lost. Now, Reuven comes, puts a dollar in my hand, takes my hand, and forces it into the poor person's hand and forces the dollar into his hand. Do I get credit for that charity? Why not? Because I'm a tool in his hands. You know, he did it. I didn't do it. See, someone's doing something to me. He doesn't give me credit. Make it him credit. Doesn't give me credit. Why should I get credit for that?
As far as free will has to be in an environment of conflict, can you still exercise free will when you just have a lot of choices even if there's no conflict? I mean, it's still an exercise of some form of free will.
What's the conflict? I mean, why are you choosing? Why not do them all? Yes.
With the example which you pointed out, what's that study? Because I would climb a number of levels. How can a person tell? That's just not a result of their personality. I've got a competitive personality. When put in a competitive environment, my nature is to, choose a certain way. So you can never tell that maybe you're just choosing that 51% pull over you rather than the 49% pull. I choose to, let's say, I'm sitting in an apartment and everyone's getting up to W in the morning. Now, I've got a conflict, okay? So maybe it's just my nature that I don't want to be the one left out, the peer pressure. So you never know inside yourself which conflict has the greater pull over you. You could just be, you could be running on a robot your whole life.
Okay. I will say a little bit about this, if I can get away with it. I can't get away with it, I have to say a lot about it. I think many people, intuitively have two ideas, and if you think about both of them together, you have a gigantic contradiction. And you have to somehow sort it out. On the one hand, I think every one of us very often makes a choice and thinks back and says, I could have chosen either way. Indeed, in similar circumstances in the past, I have chosen the other way. Sometimes I choose this way, sometimes I choose that way. You think of it as a conflict situation where you're struggling. Sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. The drinker says, person who eats too much, is overweight. Sometimes he wins the battle with his appetite, but he loses the battle. He says, listen, I know I won on Monday and I lost on Tuesday. I could have won on Tuesday too. Tuesday's challenge wasn't different from Monday's challenge. I felt, as I did it, that I could choose either way. And I chose this way. I'm sorry, of course, I regret it. I'm going to try harder next time. That's one thought that we all have. That I chose this way, but I could just as well have chosen the other one. The other thought, the other natural thought that people have is, look, I have motivations, desires, hopes, fears, scruples, values, and they're pushing and pulling me in a variety of ways. Might it not be, notice the shift in vocabulary now, might it not be that what I do is just responding to the strongest pressure? Sometimes this pressure is stronger, sometimes that pressure is stronger. Maybe I'm not making any choice at all. I'm just being pushed and pulled by a variety of pressures. And the strongest pressure or the strongest combination of pressures is what determines what happens. Now, if that's true, then, really, last time, when I decided this way, I couldn't have decided the other way. Because last time, when I decided this way, it's like the sum total of the strongest pressures that pushed me that way. And so indeed, I wasn't able to decide the other way. So now I have these two intuitions. On the one hand, I feel that I could just as well have done the other. My experience of the event, of the decision, of the choice, of the struggle, was relevantly similar to the other cases where I chose the other way. And therefore, on one side, I'm convinced I could have done the opposite. And that's why I hold myself responsible for doing the opposite, for doing what I did. And on the other hand, the thought occurs that maybe I'm just being pushed around by what happens to be the strongest combination of motivations. Which would mean, strictly speaking, I couldn't have done anything else. But I guess, strictly speaking, I'm not responsible for what I do. These are two natural thoughts that people have. And they conflict with one another.
What about doing the right thing for the wrong reason?
Okay, well, leave that for a second. That's a fine point in the nature of responsibility and credit. Let's talk now about whether or not my choice is really mine, whether or not the choice is something that could have been done otherwise, or whether it's just responding to some... Now, there's considerable discussion of this in philosophical sources. I'll tell you what I think. I'm largely quoting John Searle here. First of all, notice the shift in vocabulary. The first intuitive thought was, I surely could have done it the other way. That's the way it feels. When I think back on it, that's the way it seems to me. That's a direct intuition, a direct experience. The second thought was, maybe, really, it's the strongest combination of motivations that's pushing me to do it. That's not the same vocabulary. That's already a theory. Maybe, against what I experience, against what I feel, against what I think, against my intuitions, maybe it's really different from what I feel, different from what I think, different from what I intuit. Maybe it's really something else. Something else that I don't feel. Something else that I don't see. Something else that I don't experience. Maybe. So the two thoughts aren't really on a par. One is what I directly experience, feel, and intuit. And the other is a suggestion that maybe it's really different. I mean, maybe it is, but the two thoughts really aren't a par. Since they're not on a par, I think the second intuition needs more of a push than just maybe. Now, it's true that we make mistakes about our motivations. That's true. And it's true that we make mistakes about various things in life. But for the things that we experience, feel, believe, and judge naturally, merely the suggestion that it might be different usually isn't enough to dislodge commitment to what you feel and naturally experience. If the suggestion that it might be different is accompanied with some reason to think it's different, some evidence that it's different, then yes, I will have to take it seriously. But usually, the mere suggestion that it's different isn't enough to dislodge what seems natural, obvious, and immediate experience. So I think that just suggesting it isn't enough, really, to cause a person to doubt that what he naturally experiences is true. That's point number one. Searle goes further than this. Searle makes several more points. One of the points is this. Here's what I experience. Shall I do A or B? Well, let's see. In favor of A, I have reasons 1, 2, and 3. In favor of B, I have reasons 4, 5, 6, or 7. Which one shall I do? I don't know. I'll think about it. I feel pulled one way, I feel pulled the other way. Maybe in thinking about it, I tear up the other two reasons. Oh, yes. So for A, I have 1, 2, 3, and 4, and 11. And for B, I have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 13. Okay? Still haven't made up my mind. Now think about it for a day, 2 days, 3 days. A and B are still there. The reasons are all there, and I'm still thinking. The reasons are all there, the motivations are all there, and I'm still thinking. And finally I say, yes, I'm going with A. Now, I think it's going to be an uphill battle to describe this as the strongest combination of motivations pushing me willy-nilly over the hill. Because, presumably, all the motivations were in place for 3 days, and I didn't go over there. Nothing changed in the last 3 days. At the end of the 3 days, I decided to do A. Well, but nothing new came into the picture. So, you know, once all the forces are in place, then the stronger forces should overpower the weaker forces, and it should go over the hill. So the pause and the sense that I have to decide doesn't fit well with the picture that I'm just being pushed willy-nilly over the hill. That's one thought. Another thought, this is really astounding. Another thought is this. I think we all have the common experience that I'm deciding between A and B. And I think I have two reasons to do A. I have two reasons to do A. And then I decide to do A. And someone says to me, why did you do A? And I say, I did it for reason one. So he says, what do you mean you did it for reason one? I thought you had two reasons. And I say, yes, I had two reasons, but I only did it for reason one. I didn't do it for reason two. I chose what reason to do it for. Now, if these reasons are just forces pushing me, it's very strange to say that I didn't respond to one of the pushes. And indeed, although Searle doesn't say this, I'm sure he meant it. Indeed, it might make a difference in practice. Let's give the reasons weight, the weight of the push. So let's say reason one has weight 5 and reason two has weight 10. So the sum total of the weight is 15. Now let's suppose B has weight 9. If I choose to do A for reasons one alone, and B comes on the screen, I won't do A. Because B has a weight of 9. If I choose to do A for reason B alone, or for reason 2 alone, I will do it. I can choose the reason for which I do it, which means I choose the strength it will get. Now, he gives the example of voting for president. They say, the candidate is somebody with whom I went to college and we were drinking buddies. And he has certain policies for the country that I approve of. Well, I help out my drinking buddies. You know, I'm loyal to my college drinking buddies. I also do things to promote certain national policies. I'm motivated in both directions. He asks me, what reasons do I have? What reasons in my psychological world are relevant to voting for this guy for president? The answer is, drinking buddies and policies. Now, comes to the crunch, I vote for him. Somebody says, why did you vote for him? I said, well, I voted for him for his policies. He was your drinking buddy? Yeah, but when you vote for president, you shouldn't take that into account. So I just disregard him.
Now, what do you mean? But it's there. It's in your motivation. It's a push. Yeah, it's a push, but I disregarded it. I knew that was. And therefore, had the other candidate had slightly better policies, I would have voted for the other candidate. Even though this candidate has two pushes. He has the picky buddy push also. But I wouldn't take it into account. Now, according to the being pushed over the hill by the strongest combination of forces, it's a very peculiar thing to try to explain. The third point that he makes is this. What we are proposing, the second intuition, what the second intuition is proposing, is that really we are motivated to act in a way in which we're not conscious. We're conscious of making a choice. We're conscious of having alternatives. We're conscious that we could have done otherwise. The suggestion is that's all a mistake. It's all a mistake. Really, we are being totally determined by unconscious motivations. Now, we know people who suffer from that. People who are pushed by unconscious motivations. But their experience is utterly unlike ours. These are people who know that they're out of control and don't know why. These are people who consistently shoot themselves in the foot and have the foggiest idea why. And the psychotherapist says you're fighting with your father, every employer is a father image, and that's why you drive yourself out of a job and so forth and so on. These people describe themselves as out of control. So the suggestion that's being made is that we assimilate one type of experience to a cause which in all verified cases produces a very different type of experience. I suppose that's conceivable to be true, but the available evidence is that it's not true, because otherwise the experience wouldn't be the experience that we have. The experience that we have is quite different from cases of psychological compulsion. Now, is any of this a foolproof refutation of the idea? No, but I think it makes it a very, very questionable idea. An idea which it's hard to take seriously without some positive evidence on its side, rather than just being suggested as a possibility.
Okay, I want to try to answer that question a little bit differently. Even if you take the strongest combination of forces and ruling you, you perceive that the forces inside you are still a perception of, you know, these forces, and the perception, if you take a step back, you have a free will to develop that perception. So even if at that moment, maybe at that exact moment, according to your example, you may not have the free will, but before that, you have the ability, the free will to develop the perception, so that at the time, you'll have, you know, the free will just decided beforehand.
The answer is, you just push it back one step. All of what you described will be the result of other forces. That's not
going to
work, I don't think. Yeah.
So I think this one's a couple of problems I've got. First of all, you said a person looks back who says, I could have chosen differently. So I think there's probably two problems with that. First of all, we like to think we've got free will. To think that I don't have free will is very problematic. No one wants to walk around with that concept in their mind. Secondly, by removing a person from the situation where they made a decision in, you're a lot more objective. You can't put yourself in that back in that same situation and understand all the motivations of the time. Like you're looking at it much more logically. Also, in the case of the Hill example, maybe it's built in with us a motivation to stop and think before I make a decision. So that's part of the motivations.
I understand the first point. I would like to think that I'm alive. I don't believe that has any influence whatsoever on my belief that I'm alive. The mere fact that I'm alive to believe something does not mean that it has any effect on my believing it. None whatsoever. To say that I would like it has no reason to make me think that's why I believe it, unless there's some further reason to think that that's affecting my actual belief process. So just pointing out that I would like it, I think has no relevance here. I'd like to think that my keys are in my pocket and not lost. That has no effect whatsoever on thinking my keys are in my pocket. The only time it's appropriate to appeal to the fact that I would like to think it is if you have external evidence that my thought is wrong, and you try to explain how I get the thought wrong. But just pointing out that I would like to believe it is no reason to doubt the accuracy of the thought. That's point number one. Point number two, in many cases, I'd much rather believe that I didn't have the choice. especially when I do something wrong. I would much rather believe that I didn't have a choice because then I'm not responsible. If I believe I had a choice, then I have to take responsibility. So it seems to me that if I really were in the grips of believing what I like, I would split my ticket and say, but then I couldn't help it. But we don't do that. I mean, there are times when we do it, but it's true. We couldn't help it. But very often we opt to maintain the true perception that we did have a choice and take responsibility for what we did. So there's no reason whatsoever to think that our wanting to believe it has any effect whatsoever on our believing it. This is a very standard move. And it has to be resisted, I think, in principle from the outset. The mere fact that you would like to believe something doesn't mean that your judgment in that particular case is corrupted. Now, the idea of the delay itself is subject to the same perception. How long should the delay be? That's up to me. I can decide when I like, unless something forces me to decide. Usually, my perception is that I'm delaying it because I'm not ready to make the decision. And when I make the decision, it isn't as if the straw is broken and I'm pushed in that direction. It's the same perception that it's really up to. And the idea that I can act on the basis of one reason and not another, that's, I think, an astounding observation, and it has to be dealt with. At any rate, in terms of general logic, merely suggesting an alternative possibility is not enough to challenge a belief. If the belief is based on a natural perception, one needs more than that. This is a general point of logic. Someone says 2,000 years ago that the earth is in motion. And the response is, the earth is moving? Are you joking? Look around you. You can see the earth is not moving. You can feel that the earth is not moving. Someone to say, isn't it possible that the earth is moving even though you don't feel it and you don't see it? The answer is, sure it's possible. And it's possible that leprechauns also. I mean, anything's possible. But if I perceive the earth as not moving, and I experience the earth as not moving, to get me to think that it's moving, you've got a lot of work to do. Now, if you show me a pendulum that rotates its plane of swing every 24 hours and run in a circle, now I've got a problem. Because here I see something else that I'm experiencing, and the earth is stationary. I can't imagine why that happens. Then somebody says, you know, if the earth is rotating on its axis, that explains why the pendulum's plane rotates 360 degrees in a day. All of a sudden, I have contradictory experiences. But just to say, isn't it possible? No, that's, I don't think one has to take that seriously as a challenge. Yeah.
In the case of the guy voting for president, when he says to himself that I don't think that the fact to use my drinking buddy in college should factor into my decision, doesn't that make that motivation not a motivation anymore? He's saying that I don't want, this should not factor my decision, so it's no longer a motivation.
Well, let's see. First of all, it will work in all other decisions. He's still going to favor his drinking buddies everywhere else. It's not as if he's uprooted it. Okay, but that means that the motivation to favor drinking buddies is there.
Right, but not in this type of decision.
Well, now what happened to it?
You ruled it out of this decision.
How? Who? What ruled it out? Isn't it, I mean, if you think of motivation as a push, if you think of it as a kind of mechanical push, so it's pushing. So, you know, I decided not to take account of it. Well, how did you manage that?
You have a decision whether or not to include it as a motivation.
So that's my point. My point is that your decision can cancel the push. The opposite picture is that the push is mechanical. Right? It's like you know, a tug of war. You say, well, you know, this side is winning. I've decided not to count their first three players. So now I'm going to win. You're deciding not to count them doesn't subtract them from the rope. They're still pulling the rope. So you're going to lose. Right? You can't just subtract them. Here, the mystery is that I can decide not to take it into account, and bang, it's not taken into account. That shows that the decision is not determined that way by the psychological motivations. Now, I must tell you, in all fairness, Searle distinguishes between psychological determinism or physical determinism. What I've said, in quoting Searle, does not apply at all to the question whether or not the brain is a machine and the brain is totally determined. That's an entirely separate question. The question we've been discussing is whether or not, on the level of psychological motivations, a person is really determined. It might be that a person is determined on another level, which doesn't express itself in psychological motivations, another level of which is also totally unconscious. And that has to be discussed in an entirely different context, and indeed he develops a separate chapter of the book to that question, and he has an argument against that proposition also. So I have not discussed all facets of determinism as a challenge to free will. But this one challenge, that you're really psychologically determined, you know, in a way that a Freudian or a Jungian or Adlerian would recognize, that's what's being discussed. Yes?
You're talking about psychological and logical. Someone is drowning, and you're a psychological, you don't need to think, the immediate reaction is to go and say, but then the person who is thinking logically says, wait a minute, I can't swim, so what be the good? I'll drown as well. So, good judgment comes into play there.
Yeah, no question. A person who responds to his impulses is going to end up making bad decisions. That's quite true. Now, someone asked about doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. Exactly. How did you think of that as coming in here?
So just in terms of, because you're doing the right thing, but you haven't necessarily made a good decision because you're doing a good thing.
Okay, you're right. This is a very, very tricky issue. Let me complicate it. Can a person know that he's making the right decision for wrong reasons? He himself acknowledges that the reasons are wrong? Or are you thinking of a person who is misled as to the reasons? He thinks they're right reasons, but they're not right reasons. There are two very importantly different cases here. Okay. So now, the Gemara discusses such a case, as supplemented by Rosh Salanta. The Gemara has a statement that a person who does the right action for the wrong reasons will eventually come to do that action for the right reasons. He'll outgrow the need for the wrong reasons. So Salanter says it works like this. The person knows that the action is right. And he knows what the right reason is. And he's motivated by the right reason. Trouble is, he's also motivated by counter-motivations. And typically, he feels himself not strong enough to make the right decision. Like getting up to daven in the morning at the right time. The person says, I know I ought to do that. I know I ought to do it. I ought to do it because of the mitzvah. And I have a motivation to do mitzvahs. But usually I'm so tired or lazy in the morning, you know, I punch the snooze alarm and I go back to sleep. Now he says, suppose I set up a wrong reason. I'll set up a wrong reason. What would be a wrong reason? Behavior contract. You talk to behavior psychologists, right? I promise myself that I get up 5 days, I'll treat myself to a $25 present. Right. Check off the days. So now I'm doing it for money. How am I doing it for money? Now here's the crucial point. I want to do it because it's a mitzvah. But I'm not strong enough to make the right decision because it's a mitzvah. So, in order to be able to do the mitzvah, I add money as a motivation. Right? Under those conditions, the Talmud says, it promises that eventually God will grow the need for the money. Under those conditions, you get credit for the mitzvah, only, not the top-level credit, doing what's called the shmok, for its own sake. But you definitely get credit. But the crucial point here is that the wrong reason was put in place by a desire to do it for the right reason. Right? It didn't come in extraneously. Now, if a person does the right action for the wrong reason, and he himself has no motivation to graduate to do it for the right reason, then he doesn't get credit. And the standard example here is professors of Talmud, who are not religious, and who also don't understand what they're teaching. But that's not my point at the moment. And they teach Torah, study and teach Torah their whole lives, and it has no effect on them whatsoever. And they never graduate. They're doing it for money, they're doing it for prestige, they're doing it because they enjoy the argumentation, and not because of being a mitzvah. And they never graduate. They're not counterexamples to the Talmud's rule. They don't fit the conditions of the Talmud's rule. Talmud's rule is only where the wrong reason is created for the sake of adding to the right reason to have enough strength to be able to make the right decision.
Yeah.
Going back to what you said before about usually acting on impulse can lead to a bad decision. Sorry, but I have to disagree with that.
You're not going to disagree with that. You can't. It's impossible to disagree with that.
Would you say that instinct and the impulse is the same thing?
No. Number one, but I would say it's true for both of them. Acting on instinct certainly will very often lead to bad decisions. He didn't say, and I'm not confirming that it's always bad. He didn't say that. He said often it will lead to bad decisions. And that is certainly true. Acting on impulse and acting on instinct often will lead to bad decisions. It's possible to disagree with that. That's everyday experience.
All right. So sometimes, you may make a decision, which is the right decision, but if you spend too much time thinking about it, you start to doubt it, which could be a bad thing.
There are people with that problem. That's true. There are people with that problem. But that's only something which may happen some of the time. The vast majority of what you do, you don't do on the basis of first impulses. You know, write a letter home to your parents about a sensitive issue. You better not follow your first impulse.